The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Mike Edwards for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Armchair Traveler. For the next half hour, I shall be reading to you from the News and Observer and the New York Times. Before we begin our journey on today's Armchair Traveler, please let me remind you that neither the North Carolina Reading Service nor I are endorsing any of the cruises, safaris, tours, or other travel itineraries that might be featured in the articles that we'll be reading. These are selected simply for your enjoyment and edification. Today on Armchair Traveler, let's begin with an article that may challenge what you thought you knew about world geography. Our article is headlined, A Tale of Two Rivers, and as the subhead reads, The Nile is the world's longest river, The Amazon would like a word. Originally written for the Washington Post, the article written by Terrence McCoy, Lauren Turney, and Marina Diaz, and it appeared in the June 20th, 2023 online edition of the News and Observer. Let's begin. Dateline is Rio de Janeiro. Guinness World Records, Britannica, and the U.S. government agree. The longest river in the world is the mighty Nile, the father of African rivers, Britannica says. But in Brazil, home to the powerful Amazon River, which cleaves South America more than slithers across it, the Nile's standing is slightly lower. Second biggest river in the world, scoffs Portuguese-speaking Wikipedia. The Amazon is the most extensive in the world, declares the educational website Brazil School. At a time when so much of the world has been measured, so many arguments settled, tallest mountain, Everest, largest ocean, Pacific, most venomous snake, Western Taipan, the question of which river is the world's longest remains somehow tantalizingly beyond our reach. What appears at first to be a basic geographic query, a matter of cold science and hard numbers, has instead morphed into a cartographical dispute that has divided the scientific and exploration communities along the fault lines of national identity, units of measurement, and even personal peak. The Nile or the Amazon? The Nile is definitely longer than the Amazon, said Sir Christopher O'Dorishi, an English-Canadian adventurer who's journeyed to what he says is the river's far-flung source, and there is no doubt about that. The Amazon is longer than the Nile, counters Guido Gelli, the former geosciences director of the Brazilian Institute of Geography and Statistics. I have no doubt in my mind, he says. According to the U.S. Geological Survey and Britannica, the difference between their length is just 132 miles. That's less than the drive from Washington to Philadelphia. They have the Nile's 4,132 miles, barely edging the Amazon's 4,000. To try to settle the dispute, a task that some assert will never be possible, a team of international researchers and explorers are now planning to voyage the length of the Amazon. Backed by organizations including the Explorers Club, which has supported some of history's most daring expeditions, and other groups, the team is to set out next spring in the most distant reaches of the Peruvian Andes, the mountains where the Amazon is said to begin. For the next 7 months, members will map and measure the river's entire course until it reaches the Atlantic Ocean. Then, if all goes smoothly, a journey down the Nile, which might, after all, also be mismeasured, and it could be next. Well, Mount Everest has been climbed thousands of times, said a brilliant Brazilian explorer, Yuri Shinada, who is leading the mission. More than 1,500 people have rowed or paddled across an ocean, but to kayak down the entire Amazon, that has been done fewer than 10 times, and all of them were for the adventure's sake. To document the entire river, its geography, and biodiversity, this has never been done, he said. The journey will not be without its dangers. Drug traffickers use the Amazon as a smuggling route. Sections are pervaded by river pirates. In 2018, six men were charged with the murder of a British canoeist, Emma Kelty, who was sexually assaulted and killed halfway through a solo journey down the river's length. But Sonata said the risks are worth the expected results, not only to showcase the extraordinary wildlife of a river that anchors a region being pushed to the brink of collapse by illegal deforestation, but also to try to solve one of the world's last geographical mysteries. Which river, he asked, is the longest in the world? It's not an easy question to answer. Rivers, more than most geographic features, are ever-changing and prone to multiple interpretations. Floods wash away bends. Shorelines swivel. Man-made canals divert their paths. Then there's the question of where a river begins. Is it at the headwaters of the largest channel of water, the source stream? Or is it the most distant source, the faraway birthplace of the most distant tributary? Equally controversial is deciding where the river ends. Many geographers think it's where the main stream hits the mouth, but others say it's where the longest distributary comes to its end. It's the Wild West, said Matthew Hansen, a remote sensing scientist at the University of Maryland. Who's going to say, no, you can't measure a river that way? It's crazy. It's fun. It's weird. Any deviation in measurement, any change in the river's course, natural or otherwise, can yield different lengths and reshuffle the ranking. In 1846, according to the Atlas Maps of Useful Knowledge, the Amazon was the world's longest river at 3,200 miles. The Nile came in at 2,750 miles. More recently, Brazilian researchers have argued the Amazon is more than 1,000 miles longer and 87 miles longer than the Nile. Or maybe, according to the U.S. Geological Survey, it's 132 miles shorter than the Nile. It's a complicated science, and that has created leeway for people to make bold claims and to assert different points of view, said Angela Tomsell, a historian at the State University of New York at Brockport who has studied the Nile's history. We would like to have a nice pinpoint answer, somewhere we can point to on the map. This is where the river begins. But for the two most famous rivers in the world, that has not yet been possible. A decade ago, the neuroscientist James Contos wanted a change. Burned out in his profession, he hoped to pursue his passion, kayaking. Knowing Peru had some of the world's best rivers to run, he was looking at maps of the Andes Mountains when something odd stuck out to him. For centuries, people believed the Amazon source was the Marañón River in northern Peru. Then explorers argued that following another remote tributary, the Apurímac River led to an even more distant source. A 1971 expedition led by American explorer Lauren McIntyre traced the river to a faraway brook in the Andes and crowned it the Amazon's headwaters. But looking at the maps, Contos focused on a third affluent, the Mantaro River, that appeared to twist farther than the Apurímac. So he set out with the GPS, hiking books, and kayak to find out if the maps were true. He ventured into the inhospitable environment, arid, cold, thin mountain air, that couldn't have been more different than how the low, flat, hot Amazon basin was. After days of hiking, Contos found a new constant source, a modest spring near the base of a mountain. He published his research in 2014 in the scholarly journal Area. I thought I'd made a big discovery and it would be big news, he said, but other researchers immediately tried to discredit it. A moot point was how one geographer described the finding in National Geographic. A dam had been built along the Mantaro that diverts enough water during the dry season that the riverbed empties. Some scientists argued that this should disqualify it from consideration as a source. Others countered that it shouldn't matter. The river's seasonality was caused by human intervention. The argument started to sound a lot like a river squabble, one surrounding the source of the Nile. There, controversy goes back centuries. In the mid-1850s, at the height of the global exploration craze, when fame and fortune rested on bold announcements, an explorer named John Speke came out with one of the biggest. He argued in 1858 that he'd found the river's source, Lake Victoria. That proclamation has been debated ever since, and today three separate countries, Uganda, Burundi, and Rwanda, claim the source of the Nile as their own. But the controversy quiets as the Nile winds its way north, flowing into Egypt and onward to the Mediterranean Sea. With the Amazon, it hasn't been so simple. The waters of the Amazon travel thousands of miles before coming to the Marajó Island, half of the size of Portugal, wedged between the river and the Atlantic. Most of the Amazon's water gushes northward, the shortest route to the sea, but some of its tracks south, beginning a long, circuitous path toward the Atlantic. Most people consider the North Stream to be the Amazon's final say. Not Paulo Roberto Martini, 76, to prove his point. The scientist traced a map on a recent Monday morning at the Brazilian Institute of the National Spatial Research in Sao Paulo State. Here's the Breves Canal, he said, indicating a narrow blue squiggle. His finger pointed it as a blanked south, then merged into waters that flushed eastward toward the Atlantic. This path, which goes around the Marajó rather than past it, was what his team selected to measure when it set out in 2008 to compare the lengths of the Amazon to the Nile. To make things fair, they measured the Nile by the same standard, selecting its longest path to the mouth. In the final count, the Amazon came out on top, narrowly, 4,344 miles to 4,257 miles. Headlines declared the Amazon the longest river in the world, but victory was fleeting. Other scientists criticized the decision to use the Breves Canal. Some alleged the Brazilian researchers were looking for any way to make their river appear longer, gaming the measurement in order to be number one remote sensing scientist remarked. Martini said his team was surprised by the reaction. We felt very attacked, he said, so they moved on to other areas of the research. The study was never peer-reviewed, and the issue was largely forgotten. But even now, Martini thinks about the day he questioned the Nile's place as the world's longest river. It reminds him of the ending to the John Ford Western, The Man Who Shot Liberty Valance, when James Stewart admits that the success of his life has been built on a lie. His plea to set the record straight is ignored, and when the legend becomes fact, an editor tells him, print the legend. Martini wishes that next year's expedition would finally settle the debate, but he's not hopeful. The issue of the longest river in the world still isn't resolved, he said, and it won't be ever. By the way, there is a note here that's attached that says, map source data from Natural Earth and Hydrosheds, chart data source from Maps of Useful Knowledge, 1846, USGS, the National Geographic Society, and Post Reporting. The maps in the story represent what are considered the longest measurements of each river and do not represent all disputed starting points for each river. So there you go. You'll probably find that in fine print on any map maybe that you look at to see if you can settle that dispute. No doubt we'll have other updates in future episodes of Armchair Travel. We'll see. Well, if the comments in the article hold true, and we are likely to hear more about the world's longest river in future episodes, let us not tarry. Let's continue our journey today as we change course and meet the first woman to sail the voyage for Mad Men. Now, this article is one of the ongoing question and answer or Q&A format stories that the New York Times publishes in its travel section. And writer Lauren Schloss's article, appeared in the June 14th, 2023 issue. Christian Neuschafer talks about winning the nonstop round-the-world Golden Globe race and the possibility of another circumnavigation. And it has a picture of Kristen aboard the Minnehaha, her 36-foot Cape George sailboat. And let's begin with Lauren's credits. She is based in San Francisco and has herself sailed the Atlantic Ocean around Indonesia on the San Francisco Bay, and she was aboard a 32-foot sailboat at the time. Now her story. The nonstop round-the-world Golden Globe race has become a banner of retro sailing, or sailing like it's 1968. Entrants for the competition, which begins and ends in Les Sables d'Or, France, are required to sail small boats alone, using only pre-1960s era technology, no satellite communication, autopilot, cell phones, or radar. Courses are plotted using celestial navigation and a sextant. The champion this year was 40-year-old Kirsten Neuschafer, who, after 235 days at sea aboard the Minnehaha, her 36-foot Cape George sailboat, became the first woman to both complete and win the race. But Ms. Neuschafer is quick to state that being a figurehead was never the point. I did want to win, but not because I'm a woman or because I wanted to set a record as being the first woman, she said. I wanted to be a sailor and an equal. Now, her accomplishments, not only completing and winning the race, but also rescuing a fellow sailor, certainly promises to raise her profile. The Golden Globe, which debuted in 1968, looms large in sailors' lore. Much of the competition takes place in the high latitudes of the Southern Ocean, circling between South Africa and South America, around the Cape of Good Hope and Cape Horn, an area known for punishing winds and towering waves. The race has been referred to as aptly as Voyage for Madmen. Growing up in Pretoria, South Africa, Miss Neuschafer was always drawn to the outdoors and to epic experiences. I loved reading accounts of adventures, Scott and Shackleton and Edmondson, she said, of the famed 20th century polar explorers. It certainly planted the seed in my mind. After cycling solo from Europe to South Africa at 22, Miss Neuschafer began crewing on sailboats in pursuit of her skipper's license, and later, at the helm, she sailed, researched, and filmed crews around the Antarctic Peninsula and the South Georgian Falkland Islands. In preparation for the Golden Globe, her first race, she purchased and refitted Minnehaha in Canada, then sailed the boat solo to South Africa and to France for the race's start. Miss Neuschafer recently spoke about the voyage, the challenges of the doldrums, an area near the equator plagued by light winds, and the possibility of another circumnavigation. This conversation has been condensed and edited for clarity. Now the Q&A section. Despite all of your experience and preparation, was there an extra degree of intimidation around this race? Answer, I definitely had moments when I thought this could be quite scary. Before the race, I was visiting my parents in Port Elizabeth, which is known as the Windy City, and it was night when it was really windy. I was lying in my bed in the house without any danger, but I could hear the trees bending. I was thinking, well, in the Southern Ocean, you're going to experience winds that are much stronger than these winds, and on a 36-foot boat. Question, did you have any moments where you were actively afraid or simply disheartened? Answer, I did. But ironically, those moments weren't because of heavy weather. They were because of a total lack of wind. I got stuck in the doldrums just south of the equator for the best part of 2 weeks. It's often said by sailors that the most difficult moments are the calms, because when you're experiencing heavy weather, you've got something to keep you busy. There's a bit of adrenaline. When you've got completely no wind at all, it's incredibly frustrating. Question. Did you get bored or lonely? I assume that that was more challenging during the calm periods, but in general, it's a long time to be alone. Answer. I didn't often get bored. I've made sure that I took lots of reading material. It's the only mental escape. You read a book and you just submerge yourself into the world of whatever this book is describing, and there's always something to fix on the boat. There were times when I would have liked to have spoken to a friend to hear them tell me, just keep going. 8 months is a very long time to be in one place. You're moving, but the place you're in is the same. In the doldrums, I'd go for nice swims, which would help me de-stress a little. Question, was there anything that helped that you ate, rather, on the trip that you'd be happy to never consume again? Answer, two-minute noodles. They're not that great to begin with, but after a few months, I could almost taste the plastic flavor of the wrapper. Next question, how did you mark major moments on the trip? I would have a glass of wine or maybe a sip of rum. These rituals were quite important. It was very important for me in general to set milestones and not just focus on the end of the race. Question, how did you feel as you approached the end? There was a kind of sadness once I rounded Cape Horn. It felt like trying to summit a mountain. This is the summit, and here it's on its descent. There was joy, happiness, and relief. But this had become a lifestyle, and it would be ending soon. I had some trepidation about arriving in a place where I was expected. I had moments where I thought, you know, I've still got plenty of food and water. I'm still enjoying myself. I'd have no issue just to keep sailing. Question, what's next for you and the Minnehaha? Well, that's one question, she answers, that I haven't been able to answer just yet. I've put so much focus and energy toward the Golden Globe race since 2019, and now it's all come quite to an abrupt ending. I bought Minnehaha on debt, and I always plan to sell her after the race, but it's hard because I've done so much with this boat. I'd like to do a little trip to get a bit of closure, and I'll probably take a bit of a break just to digest the amazing experience. Final question, what adventures or destinations, land or sea, are high on your list of places to go? answer. I'd like to spend time in my own country of South Africa, particularly Transkei, or the Eastern Cape. It's a place that's just paradise to me. I'd like to master the language, which is Osha. I'd love to go back to the Antarctic and Falkland Islands. There are lots of places that I've been, but then again, there are lots of places I've never explored. There's still a lot to do in this lifetime, and I think at some stage, though not anytime soon, I might want to do another circumnavigation. It would be totally different because the seas are forever changing. What a story. Well, let's travel west now to see the Grand Canyon by train. Yep, an article written by Sarah Chavera Edwards as a special to the Washington Post. It appeared in the May 14, 2023 online edition of the News and Observer. And the dateline is a place called Williams, Arizona. Standing on a small rear train platform, appreciating the southwest scenery, I'm thankful to look, I took rather, the Grand Canyon Railway to visit one of the seven natural wonders of the world. It's the first time I'd taken the train to the Grand Canyon since I was a kid. When I was younger, my family would take trips to a sleepy Williams, Arizona, which is about 120 miles from Phoenix, where I live. The Grand Canyon Railway, which runs daily from Williams to the Grand Canyon, is a less common mode of transportation to see the national park. My parents and I would take the train instead of driving, and I saw it as an adventure. They even took me on the train during the winter when it magically transformed into the Polar Express. At 6 years old, I was filled with wonder when we ended up at the North Pole and Santa came on the train to give out little presents. The Grand Canyon Railway still keeps this Christmas tradition. The first passengers traveled on the Grand Canyon Railway in 1901, and the train became the most innovative mode of travel to the Grand Canyon. It's had various purposes throughout the years, including transporting supplies to build the Grand Canyon Village's restaurants, hotels, and shops. The railway has always had ties to local lumberjacks and ranchers who used it to move livestock. The train leaves Williams every day except Christmas at 9:30 a.m. and arrives in the canyon's south rim at 11:45 a.m. It allows visitors 3 hours to explore the canyon and exhibits before departing, with an arrival back in Williams at 5:45 p.m. In November and December, the schedule moves an hour earlier. It's unique because it lets you relax on the journey and take in parts of Arizona beyond the Sonoran Desert, such as high desert, prairie, and pine forest. Also, by taking the train to the historical landmark, tourists keep approximately 50,000 automobiles away from the canyon. Here's what to know to plan your own Grand Canyon Railway trip, and this is some tips that were provided by Ms. Edwards. How to book. The Grand Canyon Railway is separated into six car classes. They range from the Pullman class, starting at $67 for adults, $32 for kids. With bench-style seating and windows that are open to take in fresh air to the luxury parlor, which offers or features couches, carpeted floors, a private bar, it makes you feel like you're a baron in the Old West. And $226 for this one, and children are not permitted. And now, if you choose to stay overnight near the Grand Canyon, the railway has made it easy to combine hotels and trains with discount packages. Some include a night at a hotel just steps away from the rim of the canyon. They also come with an itinerary if you want to plan out, or take planning, rather, out of the equation. Then you have the train experience. The train depot in Williams is easy to navigate, with a ticket booth and gift and coffee shop. Because I was traveling in the winter, I waited for the train in the warmth of the indoors and sat down with a fresh cup of coffee. There's a Wild West shootout show before the train ride that I opted out of, but would be fun for kids and families. Before the 9:30 departure, a whistle signaled that it was time to board. There was plenty of staff to help me find which car I was riding in. I was in coach on the way to the Grand Canyon, but was riding back in the luxury dome. The coach class had mostly families who wanted the best value. The seating's cramped, but manageable. Meanwhile, the luxury dome on the way back was all adults. The seating was spacious, with extra cushioned seats and mini table next to the window. The train car hostess appeared in the front of the train to provide necessary information, like where the bathrooms were and how long the ride would be. The host and the hostesses are essential parts of the train because they provide not only vital information while riding, but point out wildlife and share history about the railway and the Grand Canyon. The ride itself is smooth, with transitional views on the landscape during the 2-hour ride. The different car classes offer different experiences, such as complimentary snacks and beverages in the luxury cars, along with alcoholic drinks for purchase. The Observation Dome had a champagne toast on the way back to Williams. I also bought a signature cocktail. One of the perks of being in the luxury cars is you can move between the different cars if you want to stretch your legs. You can also step outside on the platform at the end of the moving train to take in the view rushing past you. It's definitely a thrill, although I was nervous I was going to drop my phone as I snapped photos. There's entertainment on the train ride, including singing cowboys, a state marshal, and robbers. Cliff Hall, who played the state marshal, explained, "I think the train is great because you get to meet people from across the country and outside the country. You got some from Alberta, England, El Salvador, just in this little space of train." Curious about what international visitors thought about the Grand Canyon Railway, I asked British traveler Sarah Morton about what motivated her and her partner to ride the train. "I was looking up cool ways to do the Grand Canyon, and the Grand Canyon Railway came up. I love the idea of traveling in an old-fashioned way," Morton said. "I traveled on the Grand Canyon Railway in February, so there was plenty of snow on the ground at the Grand Canyon as well as at Williams. Once you arrive near the park, it's a straight route to the Grand Canyon, dropping passengers about a 3-minute walk from the south rim of the canyon. And there's a 3-hour stay at the Grand Canyon Village at the south rim after the train reaches its destination. This is enough time to explore shops, restaurants, lodges, and views around the village. There are bus routes, but I recommend staying in the area since there's plenty to do. The walking path in the village follows the rim of the Grand Canyon, so you can see different views of it while exploring. Some highlights include the Hopi House, a shop selling indigenous-made gifts, Bright Angel Lodge, and Lookout Studio, which offers one of the best views of the South Rim. And again, Sarah Edwards is based in Phoenix. And she has a Twitter account if you want to follow her, at Chavera Edwards, Chavera Edwards, Edwards, at Chavera Edwards is her Twitter account if you want to follow more from Sarah. Well, let's move to our final article, and this is a rescue story. After a 60-foot fall, hiker asked God to send angels. Idaho scouts arrived. Writer Alex Breezy's article first appeared in the Idaho Statesman and also in the May 18, 2023 online edition of the News and Observer. Boise, Idaho is our dateline. In the summer of 2017, Eric Valentine recalled that he was volunteering with an Eastern Oregon Boy Scout troop when they encountered a group of rafters in need of assistance. 6 years later, the 80-year-old retired judge and former scoutmaster was the one in desperate need of help, and the Boy Scouts showed up. Valentine, who works as a freelance photographer, was hiking the Hell's Canyon in early May and taking photographs when he lost his balance and fell 60 feet down a slope while trying to get a milkweed plant off one of his boots. According to a Boy Scouts of America news release, Boise firefighter's wife spotted Valentine crawling and was able to flag down a group of members from the Eagles Boy Scout Troop 77 who were out canoeing on the Snake River. "I asked God to send angels," Valentine told the nearly dozen members of Troop 77 in his hospital bed the following evening of May 15th at St. Alphonsus Regional Rehabilitation Hospital in Boise. "He sent me the Boy Scouts," he said. Valentine's recovered from his surgery and expects to head home to La Grande, Oregon. He had a broken ankle, cracked tibia, fractured back, and 3 broken vertebrae in his neck, but that didn't stop him from making the packed hospital room burst into laughter. During the roughly 30-minute visit, Valentine joked that he was fully prepared for his hike, like a Boy Scout should be, except that he didn't bring a buddy. So, take a buddy if you want to be really prepared for that hike, huh? There you go, my friends. That's the end of today's journey of Armchair Traveler. Hope you've enjoyed it and that you'll be with us next time. I'm Mike Edwards, and I've been reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. And I remind you that the content of our program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Armchair Traveler is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. The website again, ncreadingservice.org. Now, if you have any comments or questions, please direct them to 919-832-5138. The number again, 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.